This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
My counterparts in other countries hate me. They hate America because we have a 30-year fixed mortgage. So generally, the whole system is almost, in a sense, rigged for people to buy homes.
Well, welcome back, friends, to another engaging episode of the Color of Money podcast. I am glad to have you here with us. My name, of course, is Julia Lachey, and I am joined by my two favorite co-hosts. I also say that when Bo's missing, so in case Bo's listening, don't feel bad. But today, we have Daniel Dixon and Emmerich Peace. You know him as Unc. We have been on a roll with our guests. I am telling you, we have had the top of the top. I'm talking about the cream de la creme. I'm talking about like the who's who of real estate. We have had those people on this podcast lately. And today, friends, you'll never believe it, we have Logan Motashami here with us live in the studio. Friends, if you don't know who Logan is, clearly you're not paying any attention in real estate. Logan is a renowned expert in mortgage and housing ecosystem. He is lead analyst for Housing Wire. And so at Housing Wire, he does analysis, commentary on the U.S. economy, the real estate market. He's an author, of course. He knows data. He knows numbers. They call him the chart daddy. I'm not going to call him daddy on this podcast, but that's what they call him. They call him chart daddy. They call him chart daddy. And he's here to talk to us about what is going on in the real estate economy. He's here to talk to us about growing and building wealth, about making better real estate business. What do we need to know? So with all of that, friends, would you help me welcome our guest today, Logan Motashami?
I said they call me the chart daddy for a reason, so it's all good.
Hey, Logan, welcome. Thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Logan.
How I got to be in this position was kind of like a tragic accident. Our family's been in banking since the late 1950s. I was a loan officer for 17 years. But in 2010, a man named Jason Resnick, who runs a financial website, Benzinga, asked me if I wanted to write about economics. And from that point on, I started to just write about the housing market and the general economy. But by 2015, because that started around 2010, I decided, let's make this like a real-time analytical work because there's so much bad information out there on the internet, right? I always say that doom porn really sells well, but really like economic work, you know, kind of should be boring. So I thought, let's make it a little bit more fun. And then in 2019, the last 2 weeks of 2019, Housing Wire hired me just to write maybe one or two articles a day. Then COVID came, right? And then, of course, a lot of my work for economics was really tilted for years 2020 to 2024 were going to be a bit different. And when COVID came, everybody went into depression mode. And what I'm kind of known for is on April 7th, 2020, I always ask everybody, what were people doing on April 7th, 2020? Were you hoarding toilet paper or not? On that day, I wrote the COVID-19 recovery model saying that not only is housing going to be back in about, you know, 7 to 8 weeks, but the U.S. economy is going to recover this year. Housing Wire thought, you know, let's not publish this. This sounds too crazy. But I said, no, let Dr. Frankenstein do his thing. Everything worked out perfectly. And then from then on, became more popular on the national scene. We have a thing called a Nerd Tour. I tour the country and I give live presentations. I'm a little bit more lively than my fellow economists. Of course, I have better hair and I dress differently. But I try to make economics fun for people because if real estate agents and mortgage loan officers and just the general consumer understand stuff better, they won't get kind of caught into the, you know, the social media doom porn network where you don't get a lot of good information.
Yeah, that's kind of my goal.
I used to be a former high school basketball coach. I was a historian. So my job is to teach. But in this day and age, we want to teach and make it fun and understandable so that information could get spread on more and more.
You know, they've called you one of the most accurate housing market analysts in the country. Like, obviously, you said what you said about 2020 and it happened, right? But what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions that people still have about the current real estate market and how do they kind of affect us?
Just in general, what happened in 2008 in housing was an anomaly in the history of housing economics. And a lot of times in my presentations, I'll show like, home price data going back to 1942. And not a lot of people know this. The hottest home price growth period was actually 1943 to 1947. In the late 70s, home prices actually grew faster from 77 to 79 than 2020 and 2022. We had double-digit mortgage rates back then. So just the general economic flows of data for housing always gets tilted to what happened in 2008. So a lot of my work, understanding how credit markets work, mortgage debt, economic cycles, I try to frame that housing 2008 was actually the anomaly going back 8 decades. You can't just say that. You got to show people. So I call it crayon economics, the charts I bring out. I draw black lines everywhere and say, this happened there. This is not happening now. And we still have this notion that housing acts like stocks, where the velocity of prices falling, like we saw from 2007 to 2008, is normal. That's actually not normal, just because generally homeowners buy homes to live in there and they live in there for a long time. They don't act like, how I say, middle-aged men podcast stock traders, right? They don't just, you know, relinquish their house because it's shelter costs. So my job is to kind of get people away from that, because what happened in 2020 was housing inventory broke to all-time lows, where home buyer demand was at pre-cycle highs. That was actually not a very healthy thing. So everybody kept on talking about home prices crashing in 2020, 2021, 2022, and all this. But my job is to teach them why it doesn't happen. So it's been positive for me to get the feedback over the last few years, but seeing people understand it and talk about it and show their clients and show their friends. But I always say that every family has an Uncle Dave. Uncle Dave at Thanksgiving and Christmas tells all the kids, don't ever buy a house. Home prices are going to crash. Yeah. We always want to go after Uncle Dave and have everybody become versed with a lot of information.
Well, Logan, you've been a big proponent on more inventory for as long as I've been following you. We need more houses. We need more houses. We're seeing inventory increase, I think it was like 33 or 35% year over year right now. And we're seeing sales decrease lower this year than we saw in the previous 2 years. Is that going to put pressure on home prices? Do you see home prices staying flat or those going down too?
I actually think home sales will be positive this year versus the last 2 years. How we track housing is a little bit different. We have this weekly tracker where we track weekly pending contracts, weekly sales, but also the purchase application data. We try to model it out. Oddly enough, with all the crazy headlines this year, purchase application data from the Mortgage Banking Association has been positive 21 straight weeks in a row. It's had double-digit year-over-year growth the last 8 weeks. It takes about 30 to 90 days for that to filter itself into the sales data line. So for the next 5 months, we're going to have positive year-over-year data just because we're working from very low levels. And a lot of times the charts that I show that are very historical in nature, what's happening now is somewhat very normal. We have a period of time where rates go up, sales fall. And then usually what happens when a recession happens, housing starts to outperform. My forecast going into the year was a lot lower than other people. I only had 1.77% nominal home price growth nationally. I still think that'll be correct. There's parts of the country that have a lot more inventory than others. They're more susceptible to price declines. But as a country, we're going to be basically flat to low single digits, which looks very normal in the history of housing economics going back post-World War II, when you had so much housing inflation in a very low amount of time. And when we talk about inventory growing, historically, if we want to use the NAR data, active inventory is normal between 2 to 2.5 million. What's happening right now is currently the seasonal peak period in 2025 has hit the bottom level of 2019 inventory data. 2019 was a 5-decade low before COVID. So inventory is growing, but I would say it's just growing from an unnaturally low base that we've never seen in modern day history. And we're just trying to get back to normal. And it's the best thing to happen for housing, because a lot of people are confused. Why is mortgage demand picking up? Cash buyers are down as a percentage of sales. But every year that goes by, wages grow, household formation grows. We are not very complicated people. We rent, we date, we mate, we get married 3.5 years after marriage. We have kids, we buy homes. This normal activity has been here for decades. Millennials are still the biggest housing demographic patch ever. Gen Z is starting to buy homes a little bit earlier than millennials were. There's more Gen Z workers than baby boomer workers, and there's about almost 50 million millennials. So housing demand When I look at it, total home sales are going to be a little bit above 5 million. The peak in the last decade of total home sales was roughly near 6 million. So we're missing about a million mortgage buyers. And every year that goes by, wages grow, household grows, and then the demand, which is we're going to see the growth in the next few months. This is happening with elevated rates. When mortgage rates just go to 6%, the growth would even be better. If you get sub 6% mortgage rates, you get the builders, new home sales is back in 2019 levels still. That equates to about 1 to 1.2 million more existing home sales. So eventually in time, rates do fall, but the backdrop is more healthy now because it doesn't do anyone any good when home prices are escalating out of control or growing so much faster than wages. That's why I love this housing market 2025 and 2024 better than what we saw during COVID. Even though sales were much higher, the home price growth was so hot in such a short amount of time, it just kills future demand, where 2025 and 2024 are laying the foundations for many years of home sales growth.
Quick, to stay on purchase application, we see an incredible amount of pent-up demand that's on the sideline. I know you don't like about on the sideline, and they're not just monitoring rates, so don't yell at me about that. But we have a lot of people that we've pre-approved that have not gone under contract on houses. But then I just read an article in the, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, that said that we have three times more home buyers than we have active listings. So I'm confused with the data and what you're looking at versus what some of these other folks are looking at.
So the Redfin data that everyone like caught on to, kind of ignore that. That was like a tricky chart. What happens with purchase application data? Purchase application data usually takes 30 to 90 days before it hits the sales data line. Our weekly contracts, which is like 1 to 3 months ahead of the existing home sales, actually is just gone positive year over year the last 6 to 7 weeks. So we get to see these homes going on to contract. It's going to take like 3 months before you see it on the existing home sales. But this is happening with elevated rates. Usually housing demand picks up when mortgage rates head down towards 6%, not be picking up near 7%. So we're missing about 3.9 to 4.7 million home buyers currently that would have normally been here if home prices didn't escalate out of control and rates escalate out of control. Okay. Every year that we're around 4 million existing home sales, that pent-up demand, the demand that usually is there every single year after 1996, is just picking up. And that I use that as the explanation why there's more people applying for mortgages now than the last 2 years. But it does take some time because we have to remember days on market are trying to get back to normal. A normal days on market taking the NAR is about 30 to 45 days. We got to a very unhealthy level. We got to teenager levels. I always say whenever days on market is at a teenager level, it's terrible news. You either have not a lot of homes, too many people chasing too few homes, or there's some kind of massive credit boom that's going to bust. So days on market are taking longer. Transactions take a little bit longer to close, but our weekly contracts are finally showing year over year growth. It'll show up in the data in the next few months, but we're talking still minimal growth on a year over year basis. If rates just get down to 6, you could get a little bit more sales because home sales have held back for so long, but all those people, their wages rise, their household formations, dual household incomes come in. As long as home price growth stays very slow and inventory builds up, it's a better foundation for growth for the next few years. And that's very common going back to every housing cycle post-1968. Sales decline, they stay flat for a little bit. And then when rates fall, they pick up for the next few years. And that cycle happens over and over again for many decades.
So I think he's telling us we're at the bottom.
We bottomed out in home sales in November, December of 2022. The last 2 years, total existing home sales have been just a tad above 4 million. We haven't broken underneath there. And this is the first year in many years. I haven't been able to say this for so long. It's weird to even say this. Literally, we have 21 straight weeks of positive year-over-year data with purchase application data, but the last 8 weeks have been double digits. And that's with elevated rate. That's the thing that I tell people. Mortgage rates get down 6%, the pool of buyers pick up, but also the natural buyer that usually has been here for the last few years, they start coming into the mix a little bit more. And you can get home sales growth. It's not going to be anything spectacular, but we bottomed out at the end of 2022 and we're just kind of waiting. And the charts that I use at events, people could kind of see this. This is actually kind of somewhat common to other times in history. You have a few years where sales stay low and then rates fall and then demand picks up for many years.
I have like so many questions based on all that you said. But one of the first things you said, there's 1 million mortgage buyers missing. So for the real estate agents that are listening, where are they?
When we think of home buyers in America, we have to think of kind of the five generation pillars. There's Gen Z, millennials, Gen X, our generation is the best, by the way, and baby boomers and silent generation. So what you have is the move up buyer, move down buyer. There's the cash buyer, investor, but you also have the first time home buyer. And what happens every time mortgage rates go down 1%, that buyer pool picks up. And then you tend to get more people applying for mortgages. That's been the case since the end of 2022. This is the first year that it's happened with elevated rates. But if rates get down to 6% or even go lower, that pool of buyer picks up and then everyone gets to see total demand pick up out there. It becomes more apparent because for every 1% mortgage rates go down, it's like 3 to 4 million people can qualify. And even though affordability is really bad now, we had worse affordability data in the 1980s. And in the early 1980s, home sales crashed. Everyone said everyone's going to be a renter. Nobody's going to buy homes. There was 2 recessions back then. We had more inventory, bad credit data. And mortgage rates fell 2.5% and sales started to grow. And they fell another 2.5%, went from 18 down to 13%. And then sales started to noticeably pick up. So history is kind of repeating itself. The only thing we're missing here is mortgage rates heading lower.
About that, Logan, that's the crystal ball we want you to have. Do you think that the rates are going to drop anytime soon? And if so, when?
To me, the mortgage rates really revolve around economic data and labor data. So the labor data is getting softer. Mortgage rates are kind of heading down towards 6%. But when the Federal Reserve starts its rate cut cycle, whenever they start continuing it, 65 to 75% of where mortgage rates and the 10-year yield can go is Fed policy. So once you start getting if you get 1 more percent of rate cuts into the system, which right now a lot of people are pricing in a lot more rate cuts in 2026, you get that. You could get to 6% easier, and then you could go lower than that. So there's a lot of variables now that are different, I would say, than the last 2 years. And also, we're going to get a change in the Federal Reserve next year as well. So we'll see how the Federal Reserve treats monetary policy going out in 2026. But if the labor data starts to get weaker, housing tends to outperform in recessions, then mortgage rates can go lower for a longer period of time. But right now, I'd say the slow move down to 6% is still in play, even for this year. But next year becomes a lot more interesting because there's a lot more rate cuts and more dovish language in 2026. But we've already made a move from 7.5% toward the middle point of last year. We're now down to about 6.7%. That next move lower is going to be key because we always see housing data start to pick up a little bit more when rates head down towards 6%.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
I'm breaking this down a little bit differently, right? And for our listeners, in this particular market, and correct me if I'm wrong, or tell me what your thoughts are. There's a new sentiment about home ownership in the new generation of buyer. What I mean, we went through that little phase and said, well, don't buy a house, just go rent. Renting is better than owning. Based on the increase in applications, what that would appear to indicate is that there are more people who are willing to buy and they're probably able to buy. The magic point is, the magic tipping point is when that interest rate goes lower.
Millions and millions of people buy homes every single year. They bought homes in 2008. They bought homes during COVID. I would say this, there hasn't been anything in the data over the last, I would say, 7 to 8 decades that say general people who incomes qualify for homeowners want to be renters instead of homeowners. The benefit of being a homeowner in America, I would say my counterparts in other countries hate me. They hate America because we have a 30-year fixed mortgage. So generally, the whole system is almost, in a sense, rigged for people to buy homes. Because why? What's the difference between a homeowner and a renter? a homeowner has a fixed debt cost. And their fixed debt cost means that every year as their wages rise, that debt cost becomes lower and lower for them. Where a renter doesn't necessarily have that advantage. And then you own your home. So I've never seen anything in the data actually for the last 2 decades that I've been tracking housing that says people rather be renters than homeowners, because you want rather own something, you have a fixed debt cost, and it's your own home, right? That's the ownership aspect is why so many people, and even this year, a lot of people are saying, well, no one's going to buy, mortgage rates are too high, tariffs, crazy headlines and everything. And literally, purchase application data has had its first positive year in many years, and that's with mortgage rates still elevated. So yeah, I generally don't agree with the people that say people rather rent to buy, because the income pools that people typically have to buy homes, they're still there. And I mean, literally, we're only missing like 1 million mortgage buyers from the peak of the last decade cycle highs. So considering how unaffordable housing is in historical terms, people are ready to go. Whenever rates get down towards 6%, we see the data get better. But that's been the history of housing economics for decades. So I don't kind of buy into the pack that people that have the incomes to qualify for homes rather be renters. People are generally, especially when households form, people get married, they have kids, they typically buy the house and they start their livelihood there. But it's also the fixed debt cost aspect of housing, basically, in a sense, is still you're rigged for people to want to be homeowners, forced savings, homeowners' wealth and income and everything, and disposable income is so much better than renters. So I've never been in the camp that people prefer to rent than buy, because millions and millions of people buy homes every single year.
Right. So let's make this clear. I'm not in that camp either. So let's make that clear. No, I only said that because you were saying that there are more millennials and Gen Zs that are in the market that have previously been in the market than other people have been in the market previously. So if you have more people, then the applications should theoretically go up.
To me, it's been one of the more surprising data lines for other people. They can't figure it out. Like, why are people applying for mortgages? And you just want to keep it simple. Our biggest demographic patches are millennials and then Gen Z. Both those two combined are bigger than the total population of Japan. Like, Japan is like 40% of Japan's population will be dead by the end of the century. They sell more adult diapers than baby diapers. Here in America, we have a very young workforce, right? And then when you think of all the buyers put together, millennials, Gen Z, Gen X, baby boomers, and silent, this is how you get near 5 million total home sales. And this is with elevated rates and elevated prices and taxes, insurance, and everything. And still, home sales haven't declined for years now. They've kind of hovered, and then rates fall down, housing demand picks up. It looks like every housing cycle I've seen for decades out there, because people rather own their houses than be renters in general terms, those that have the incomes and the capacity to buy a home.
What I'm saying is, we as real estate professionals, we should be going out and getting more listings for more baby boomers so we can sell more houses to Gen Z and millennials.
Yes, and just remember, this is a quick model thing that I always teach people. 70 to 80% of home sellers are buyers. So this year, new listings data, we have a weekly tracking new listings data that a lot of people like. Our new listings data is positive year over year and somewhat almost getting back to normal. When those people list their house, they're selling their house, they're filling out an application, because most of the times they sell and buy another one. Right. So always think sellers or buyers. Supply is, in a sense, a function of demand. When rates fall, you get the mortgage buyer in there. The mortgage buyer then buys that house from a baby boomer. That baby boomer goes, buys another house, and that's how the transaction pool goes. And when mortgage demand picks up, you get generally more sales, because it starts the chain reaction of how housing demand works in America.
So my question was going to be, given all of that information that you just said, if somebody wanted to buy their first house, right, to get into this whole thing, or if there's an agent who is listening and they've got buyers who want to buy their first house, many of them are feeling overwhelmed by the economy right now. What would you say to help them, or to help the agents help them, make a data-informed, confident decision?
There's over 162 million people working in America. Home sales are at record low levels, and it hasn't been breaking down for the last 2.5 years. So I always say this, housing is the cost of shelter to your own capacity to own the debt. Millions and millions of people are going to buy homes this year. They're going to buy homes next year. No one's going to wait for you. You got to make that decision on your own. but the general home buyer profile has stayed intact, even with elevated prices, taxes, and insurance. So it's the cost of shelter, and that explains why we still are going to have near 5 million total home sales this year. The home buyer just is ready to go, and they want to start their life. And we have so many people just waiting that the built-up in traditional demand is ready to go once rates fall. And we see that this year. So many people were so negative on nobody is going to apply for a mortgage or anything. And literally, the data is the exact opposite. And nobody talks about it because they can't make sense of it all. But when you look at the history of economics, Americans tend to own homes rather than rent, especially when they start to get older and older. We get married and have kids a little bit older than the post-World War II generation. So that's why millennials are still such a huge home buying profile. But Gen Z is even buying homes a little bit earlier than the millennials were. So always think of housing as a cost of shelter, and 162 million people. When rates go lower, nobody's going to wait for anybody. Home sales go up, and that's how housing economics has worked for many decades.
Talking about the numbers, it brings excitement for me, and I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners, it brings excitement and optimism to our industry, because that's not what we've been getting, that certain optimism. And what you're saying, and what I'm hearing you saying, and what I believe I hear you saying, is that we're on the upswing. There are going to be a lot of positive things happening for us. We just have to know our numbers better so that we can inform our customers and clients better, and we can bring more light to this industry.
I want to tell you this. In the past, I would say 4 or 5 decades, whenever home sales start to fall and they find a low base, there's a general pessimistic outlook for housing. Nobody wants to buy homes. Everybody wants to buy a renter. And then all of a sudden rates fall, and then the market just goes off on people. And then everybody goes, what just happened? I was told nobody's going to buy a home. Everyone's going to be a renter. We do not have any data in recent modern day history that shows that. Even with what we've dealt with massive housing inflation, property taxes, insurance, rates, all this economic drama out there. And even this year, people are applying for mortgages and ready to go, because it's the structural basis of how we live our lives here in America. The whole economic ecosystem is basically designed for people to be homeowners. If I had my charts here, it'd be so obvious why people buy homes. The financial profiles of homeowners in America, it's the best I've ever seen. Like, I have a little skit. I show the FICO score charts of American homeowners. And I tell everybody, this thing is so beautiful that literally at 8 o'clock at night, I get my cognac out, I get my jazz music going, and I just sit here and look at that chart because it is so beautiful. And the world hates us for us, because homeowners, they get that house, they get that debt cost, their wages rise every single year, their disposable income becomes better. And that's why they created the 30-year fix, where a lot of countries, they don't have 30-year fixed rates. They have short-term rates. Like in Canada, they're doing 90-year loan modifications over there because they're tied to short-term debts. Their mortgages are going to outlive their grandchildren. Here, we have a different story. It's the 30-year fix is one of the greatest financial products in history, I would say. And why is it? Because it's, in a sense, the best hedge against inflation. When we talk about housing being the best hedge against inflation, it's not home prices. A lot of people just think home prices move with inflation, so that's their best hedge. But it's the fixed debt cost, because even during an inflationary time, your wages grow a little bit more than normal, but your debt cost stays the same. And that's why homeowners' financial profiles, I would say, if I took all of the history of Earth, it's never looked better in that context. Just because, another good example, from 1985 to 2007, people lived in their homes 5 to 7 years. From 2008 to 2025, it's 11 to 13 years. In some states, it's 15 to 18 years. I've lived in my home for 20 years. People are living in their homes longer and longer, and their financial profiles have gotten better. So it's almost unfair. I always say that maybe Cleopatra in her prime, adjusting to inflation, had more wealth than America. But Americans have over $190 trillion of financial wealth, and the homeowner profile on that, $52 trillion of that is home values. But the nested equity of homeowners in America is $37 to $38 trillion. That's bigger than the total GDP of China. So it's an unfair advantage because the system was designed to make people homeowners, the tax code and everything. But the 30-year fix has always been the key there.
How do you look at that? The amount of equity that we have with homeowners, but we're also at an all-time high with credit card debt. How do you balance those two facts?
nominal credit card debt always grows with expansions, and the highest credit card debt and the highest consumer debt are also the top of the financial food chain, like the middle and upper middle class. The credit stress data now, renters, when you break it down from homeowners to renters, even though renters have lower credit card debt numbers, they're seeing the highest 30-day, 60-day, 90-day. When we think about auto loans that are going delinquent, the renter financial profiles, especially single younger renters, they're the ones that have stress. But when you take it, the biggest consumer debt in America is mortgages. When you take a look at their FICO scores, it's never actually been better because they have their incomes and financial assets are better. So credit card debt growing is actually very normal. Adjusting to inflation, it's still very low compared to the 2008 period. Okay. And as a percentage of disposable income, it's still very low in that context. That's why, to me, it's never been a big economic issue. But if you break the data down and you move from renters to homeowners, you really see the stress in the renter financial profiles. And naturally, because the renter financial profiles have less income and less financial assets.
You said something about the 30-year mortgage being a tremendous tool in America. And you said stabilized living expenses. This is something I've been saying for years. And we're talking about home buyer, homeowners, mortgage applications in recent time. So let's wrap our brain around this. We have a 30-year mortgage. You buy a house when you're 30 years old. By the time you're 60, you pay that house off. You're mortgage free. For all intents and purposes, you're massive debt. You're debt free. So now you can live off of 20% of your income as opposed to living off of 65, 70% of your income. By the time you reach that retirement age, which will be 70 by then, you'll be completely debt-free. And if Social Security is there, you can technically live off of Social Security by the time you're 70. Because if you bought a house when you were 30, you have no living expenses except taxes, insurance, and utilities. I think that's a big conversation.
Let me give you a good example of that. Let me use my parents. My parents bought three homes in their lifetime. And the last home they purchased, they got a mortgage. And now that house is paid off and it's $1.7 million. 40% of the homes in America don't have a mortgage. Yeah. So the baby boomers bought a house, they paid it off. But also when they downsize, especially in areas that are much cheaper. Like I live in Southern California by the water and the whole world is cheaper to us anywhere we go. But when you have so much equity, it's not even a sense of living in that same house for 30 years, is that when you downsize, you have no mortgage, your Social Security, you know, covers your property taxes and insurance and everything. And you're in a much better financial position than wherever your income is in your 60s or even early 70s, or even just taking Social Security, as a renter, you still have to pay that cost,
yes.
Right? So of course you're paying taxes and insurance, but as a renter, if my parents wanted to rent something similar, it's probably $5,000-$6,000, but now they don't have a mortgage. They just have property taxes and insurance. So in the longer sense, in the end game, your shelter cost is gonna be so much lower, even though your income will be lower than your kind of peak earning years. And that's the other benefit of housing. That's why the government created all these housing tax codes to get them in there. They make people forced savings, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just the appreciation, it's paying down. And then that's how you build that equity and that equity goes out. This is why I always say that the system is in a sense rigged for housing in that regards with all the tax codes and 30-year fix and everything in that. But when you design it on a long-term platform, you could see what the end game is.
Now, let's switch gears to foreclosures and short sales. What kind of data are you seeing around those two hot topics?
Still very small. One of my more famous charts that I use at the conferences, I always say that when I die, this foreclosure chart is going to be on my tombstone. And what it shows is that the housing, I mean, we've had many economic cycles post-World War II. We've had unemployment rates, double digits, everything before, but The housing bubble years, the unique aspect was that people were filing for foreclosures and short sales in 2005, 6, 7, and 8. Then the great financial crisis recession happened. And then after that, foreclosures didn't really grow that much into that. Here, even in 2025, the foreclosure data, delinquency data, is not even back to pre-COVID levels. And I was expecting that to happen by now. So the foreclosure data is very small. But also, when we think about foreclosure, the standard foreclosure process, it takes like 9 to 18 months before that home actually hits the marketplace. And depending on what state, some states are judicial and non-judicial. But when you have so much nested equity, you're not going to get a foreclosure crisis. So one of the data lines I'd like to use is from 2001 to 2008, down payment percentage data was falling, right? As the closer we got to 2008, there was less down payment. Today, from 2017 to 2025, the down payment percentage data has been increasing, and the recent data has it near 21 century high. So the median down payment is between 15 to 18%. First-time home buyers are 9%. The move-up or move-down buyer is much higher than that on their down payment percentage. Homeowners are already starting off with a lot of equity. I think over 82% of households have 30% plus equity in their home. So it's really hard to have like a major foreclosure crisis when your selling equity is so high. So whenever a job loss recession happens, you're going to get foreclosure risk, you're going to get increases in delinquencies. But the foreclosure data, even today, is not even back to pre-COVID 2019 levels. And that was at a very low level itself.
But what about short sales and new construction and Lennar cutting estimates and new home sales decreasing and the homes that were built in 22 and 23 selling for less than they're being sold for now? Do you see that spike?
When we think about new home sales as a small sliver of the existing homes, a good example, the last new home sales report was at 623,000. The last existing home sales report was a tad over 4 million. People stay in their homes longer and longer. New home sales have basically stayed in a range for about 7 years. We're still at 2018-19 levels, where the existing home sales market is the one that crashed and is still very low. The new home sales market is just, there's not a lot of underwater homes in America. I think the last data that I saw was 0.03% out there. So the foreclosure risks aren't in there. Like Austin is a really good example. Austin was down 22% from the high in 2022. So a lot of people said these are foreclosure risks. Those people are still, in a sense, not even underwater. A lot of them had a bigger down payment. So no matter what happens to the new home sales sector, Lennar or any of that, there is a very, very tiny percentage of homes that are even underwater. I would say that the old CoreLogic data that I saw, 2% of homes are underwater now. Back in 2010, that number was 23% of homes underwater. And also remember that FHA or VA loans, that low down payment loans, there are people that have loan to values that are 100, 115% because they have reconstruction loans.
Funding or fees.
Technically, they would be underwater. But if you take that out of the equation, it's like less than 0.5% of homes in America are underwater.
I have a very important question. And I can kind of, we can kind of wrap this up with this important question. But Logan, you work with numbers every day, home sales, interest rates, inventory levels. But behind every data point is actually a person, right? A family. And we do the same thing as franchise owners and businesses. We're P&Ls. We're looking at our numbers. We're doing it. But the reality is behind all of those numbers, there's a family who's making a life-changing decision. Can you share a moment or a story, or can you think of something that reminded you that the real estate economy is about more than just metrics? I think our leaders in real estate need to hear that answer. People who are running real estate businesses need to identify that. But what was it for you? Is there a moment for you that you realize that this is more than just metrics? There's real people involved in this.
As an LO for 17 years, you know, my job is just to basically put people into the best loan possible. But I would tell you this, when COVID was happening, and everybody stopped living for a second, and everyone was hoarding toilet paper and doing crazy stuff. A lot of my friends that work in the financial industry all came to me because here I am writing this recovery model, said home sales are going to be back. And then they're like, okay, man, I like your work and everything, but I'm just not sure about buying a home because, you know, we're about to have a kid and everything. I said, let me tell you something. Do you think you're going to live in the next 3 months? Yeah. And they're like, yeah. Okay. That home that you're looking at is not going to be here in 3 months. When people start feeling like, okay, they got to live, millions and millions of people will buy homes. And once everyone gets back to normal living in COVID, all these homes that you see for that, you know, this week might not be here. So you have to make a choice because this is your life for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And that's why I always use this skit. Human beings are very normal in terms of how they look at housing. You rent, you date, you mate, you get married. 3.5 years after marriage, you have kids. And then typically you buy a single family home. So even in the craziest time, I always like to remind people because you are looking not only for next week, but you're looking out for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So you make that choice because once you're in, you're in, you're going to be like everyone else. And the human element back then, even the craziest time in history, I never flinched. I just said, listen, in about 7 to 8 weeks, we're going to kind of get back to normal. And then people are going to buy homes again. And it happened. Literally by May of 2020, purchase application data had a V-shaped recovery and people were buying homes. That's the human element because life finds a way and people rather own homes than rent them. And that's what happened. We had this unbelievable recovery in housing, which wasn't a surprise to me, but to everyone else, the human element was being tested out there because here was like the craziest, darkest period. Everybody thinking depression. And I'm sitting here smiling and saying, oh yeah, we're going to be back like in 7 or 8 weeks. I'm more worried about home prices escalating out of control than prices crashing. And human beings find a way to progress forward or like in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. And that life is always tied to the shelter. And housing is the cost of shelter to your own capacity to own the debt. Fixed debt costs, rising wages, millions of people buy homes every year. Nothing's really changed from that.
Friends, you heard it here live on the Color of Money podcast. Logan has said it for himself. There's hope, friends. People are buying houses, millions of people every day. There's a million mortgage buyers missing. Go find them. In the spirit of Jay Papasan, what's the one thing that you would want the listeners who are listening to this information from you today to walk away from this conversation with?
Always listen to people that believe in like economic models. Nerdy people can be cool, but you have to be careful of listening to your Uncle Dave or to some jackass on YouTube or people on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. Millions of people can have opinions, which is fine. But if you're trying to get real data, you're going to have to get it from the nerdy people because they can show you the history of housing economics, what has happened in the past, what's happening right now, and what's happening in the future. You have to value yourself more when you get that information than to listen to some people who are just spreading doom and gloom all the time.
I love that. Thank you for being here. Friends, tune into Logan's podcast. He's on Housing Wire. You can find him one time a week, two times a week, maybe even four times a week. You can find Logan on the Housing Wire podcast, giving you more information that is super relevant to our business and absolutely relevant to building wealth. Logan, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.